Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth online at commonwealthclub.org or on the Facebook page, YouTube, and on Twitter at CWLUB. At CWCLUB. I'm Laura Seidel. I'm the digital culture correspondent for NPR, and I am your moderator for tonight's program. And it is truly my pleasure to introduce our guest, Dana Boyd. Dana is a principal researcher at Microsoft Research. She is research assistant professor in media, culture, and communication at NYU. She's a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center, and above all, an expert in youth culture and social networking. Dana's research focuses on the intersection of technology, society, and policy, particularly on the ways in which young people use social media. An active Twitter, blogger, and Facebook user herself, Dana has published dozens of articles on a wide variety of topics, including teen and technology issues such as privacy and bullying. In January of 2013, Dana helped co-author a book with other members of a MacArthur Foundation-funded project, Hanging Out, Messing Around, and Geeking Out, Kids Living and Learning with New Media. She's founder and president of the new think do tank called Data and Society Research Institute. Her new book, It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens, explores how our youth, and there she is, she's holding it up. Get your pictures in with the book. How our youth interact online and the myths that surround teens' use of social media. Please join me in welcoming Dana Boyd to the Commonwealth Club. So yes, and among the many media outlets that Dana has appeared on is NPR, and in fact, I have actually used you in many stories. And I enjoyed the book. I've talked to you about some of these ideas in the past, but I want to start with an idea that I think is a major premise in this book. There's a lot of coverage of teens and social media, and I've certainly been part of that trend. But in this book, you talk about how a lot of the reporting looks at how scary social media is. Teens are going to be predators there. There's bullying, there's all these horrible things. And you actually, I think, throughout the book, kind of dispel that as a bit of a myth, that it really is not as dangerous as the headlines would have us believe. Can you talk a little bit about what you really found when you started going out and talking to teens?
Sure. You know, I went into this project really trying to understand what had changed about young people because of social media, in part because I had grown up online myself, and I was really excited to see what kinds of transformations would occur. And I was actually very aware of a lot of the media conversations and the concerns, and I actually went with the eyes wide open, thinking that I would sort of make sense of this. And one of the most sort of salient of this was this concern, probably the first big concern, was about online sexual predators. This concern really sort of peaked with MySpace, when MySpace was the most popular social media site. And I tried to untangle what was going on, because it was not what I was hearing on the ground. And so I moved between what I was seeing qualitatively, ethnographically with my research, and what I was seeing more statistically with collaborators. And what I started to uncover was that the story and the narrative as it was playing out was not only a distraction, but it was actually outright destructive. So let me give some concrete examples of this. The myth of this online sexual predator is that this is this usually a typically old man who's reaching out into the screen and grabbing a child randomly, and then terrible things happen, right? And we hear this, and we saw a lot of TV coverage where the idea of To Catch a Predator came out, this kind of story thing. But when we started to look at the data, we started to see something much more different. First, David Finkelhorn.
Can I stop? You said To Catch a Predator. You should probably explain to people.
Sure.
People might not
To Catch a Predator was a TV show that was set up where people would portray themselves as young children, I hate to use the word entrapment, but I can't resist using the word entrapment. Basically, put up situations where they would be open to interactions by older men who would be engaging them around sexual contact or conduct, and then they would end up having these conversations with these older men. The men would come over to the houses. There would be a TV camera there, and in return for leniency and a variety of other things, they would basically agree to be on TV. And it was a little bit of a debacle in terms of the details of how it played out. And every teenager I interviewed was very aware of To Catch a Predator as a thing. And that was their construct of what the dangers that they faced online would be. But David Finkelhor and his team at the Crimes Against Children Research Center started to realize two important things. First, they analyzed how often a young person was sexually solicited online. Their numbers were often used by organizations like the Ad Council and by the public media to say that 1 in 7 children were sexually solicited online. And that number is true, but the thing is that people hadn't read the report. 1 in 7 young people is sexually solicited online. The majority of those sexual solicitations are by other teenagers. Right? Of those that are adults, the majority are 18 to 24. The number who are of significantly older adults isn't quite what we imagine. It's very small. More weirdly, it was that a lot of these young people reported that it was not a problem that they were receiving those sexual solicitations. So it was like, okay, what goes on? So then his team started looking at the kinds of crimes against children that would actually occur relating to the internet, started to realize a really disturbing trend. It was young people who would often portray themselves to be older, interacting online in environments in a sexualized way with people that they knew were older, meeting up, knowing it was for sex, doing so repeatedly, believing that they were in love. When you drill down on who those young people were, they were most likely to be from abusive families, to be struggling with drug and alcohol issues, to struggling with sexuality. They were at-risk youth, right? And the reason why I point this out is that this is still deeply problematic. There is a reason why statutory rape is a crime in this country. But the kinds of interventions that you need are fundamentally different when you're talking about a young person who is actually engaging about sexual activities, doing so believing that they can get love and validation, than it is if you assume a random abduction. But there's a more disturbing trend, and the reason why I get really frustrated with the sexual predation conversation is that so many of the young people I met were basically trained to look out for strangers who might sexually victimize them in ways that they never had the way of thinking about what happened when it was the people within their own community, what happened when it was their parents, what happened when it was their extended family members, and not just when it's adults. Most young people who will be sexually victimized by their peers. It is by their classmates. And we have no language or understanding of this. And so I kept hearing young people would recite back this idea that it was always about strangers, and we spent so much time in investing into thinking about these random strangers, not preparing young people to deal with the complexity of the issues, you know, in their home communities.
I mean, I think that's a theme in this book throughout, overall, which is that what's happening online is a reflection of a lot of things in the real world that parents do need to look at, but
absolutely.
You know, banning them from the internet is not necessarily going to solve the issues. You know, and in fact, on this note, another thing that you brought up in this book that I really had not thought about, but I have heard people, you know, who become parents talking about all the fears they have in the physical world and how, you know, when we grew up, you could go out on your bike, you know, and you just had to be home by after dark. There wasn't all this fear, and that we are increasingly, young people are increasingly growing up in a world in which their physical movement is being very, very restricted, even going to the mall, being able to go ride out on your bike. And so what's happening is, you know, teens particularly, they need a space to come together with their peers. I mean, that's part of being a teenager, right, is to find your identity with your peers and to say, I don't want to talk to you, mom and dad. And so what you were saying is happening, and is that essentially that is what the internet has become for a lot of the teens you talk to.
Yeah, the internet has become a relief valve. And a lot of it is to think about the transformations in American society in the last 30 years. Part of it, of course, is your industry, which is that, you know, once we started to see 24/7 news, we started to see a need to fill it. And once we started trying to fill it, there was nothing like, you know, putting out fearful messages to capture people's attention, to drive ratings in different ways. And so we started seeing this coverage that appeared in the early 1980s of terrible things happening to kids somewhere in the country. And so many parents started to believe that it was just like the things that were happening in their own home community. And there started to be an increasing anxiety about letting young people out into public. That was one trend line we saw in the 80s, but there are a couple of other trend lines that we think are really important to highlight. One is the restrictions in terms of where young people could hang out. Loitering laws, curfew laws, trespassing laws really rose in the 1980s as a way to say young people couldn't gather in public. The response to latchkey kid culture, which was the idea that you would just go home after school by yourself, maybe serve yourself a snack, in theory do your homework, in reality watch TV, that dynamic of the 1980s created all sorts of concerns about the health and well-being of middle-class youth. The result is we overstructured their lives, right? And today's young people in middle-upper-class America go from morning to night in very structured activities. As we saw suburbanization and school choice, the geographic distance between you and your closest friend actually expanded, so you didn't have the ability of just going to see your friend easily with, you know, access. Our increased response to car culture means that when you're 16 and you get a car, which was sort of a rite of passage for so many young people, became much more difficult because even if you can get a car, you can't drive your other friends around in most states. So the result of which is, what's the point of having a car? Your access to financial capital in a way that was independent was undermined, right? Newspaper jobs are gone. These kinds of, the idea of fast food jobs, they're unavailable. Babysitting, who would let a 12-year-old babysit? All of these things have changed. And so what you see is that young people have very limited access to a place that they can sort of publicly get together with their friends where they know all their other friends will be. And this is where it's a collective action problem, which is that even if you as a parent choose to let your child roam and do what they want, that doesn't mean their friends are allowed to. And so when you see that collective action problem, you see this choice amongst young people where can they get together with their friends without surveillance by parents? And what they found is finding the relief valve of through technology. And so they hop and they move from technology to technology to technology, looking for a place of their own, often trying to evade their parents first and foremost.
Which would explain, you know, what we see with something like Snapchat. I mean, you see that just every time you turn around, there's another one. Ironically, when I was this afternoon in my office, I overheard somebody say, "Oh, my grandmother's on Facebook." And really, I'm not kidding. And it's just like, I don't want her seeing everything I'm doing on Facebook, you know? And this was somebody, I mean, she wasn't really young, but still, it was just that sense that, you know, she didn't need to have
teenagers actually get away with grandparents much better. Grandparents are just entertaining, right? Which is their weird comments on Facebook, you just have to laugh at them. But once you're older, you're like, oh no, what's grandma going to do?
I mean, it's funny, in the book, you know, you talk about MySpace a lot, which of course MySpace is kind of so
passé at this point.
It's totally passé. And figuring out where teens are going to go next is difficult. And so in a way, in writing the book, you keep referencing this fact that whatever you're talking about may or may not be a big deal by the time the book comes out.
Right. The particular sites have changed, but the underlying practices, generally speaking, have not. You mentioned Snapchat, which I think is actually one of the most innovative of the new sites. It's often misunderstood within the public. Most people refer to it as like, oh, a place where young people share inappropriate images. Actually, it's the 20-somethings who are sharing the inappropriate images. But what teenagers are doing on Snapchat, by and large, is they're saying, I don't think that every picture I ever take needs to stick around for forever, because that's just weird. And so it becomes an ephemeral communicative strategy of like saying, this is funny in the moment, but neither of us are going to remember what it means 5 years from now. But there's also something else that's really elegant about it, which is that all of major social media at this point has created persistence as a normal thing, which is that everything you ever produce will stick around for forever, which is always a little weird when you're on Facebook and that thing you wrote 6 years ago suddenly pops up as like, you know, the reminder, and you're like, whoa, I'm not sure I want that. What Snapchat sort of says is that like, okay, let's play with it. Let's change the idea of persistence. And because it changes the idea of persistence, you started to see other practices emerge in light of it. So if you think about a service like Facebook or like Twitter or Instagram, where you have a large feed of stuff, most people, when they have that large feed, they're scrolling. They're paying very little attention to anything that they see in that feed. Snapchat demands something very different. It says, you've got 7 seconds or whatever it is to pay attention. And you only have 7 seconds to pay attention. So if this is important to you, stop and look at it. And what you see is that people will, you know, get a new snap and they'll be like, all right, I'm not ready to look at this right now. And then 2 hours later, they'll look at it and they pay attention for 7 seconds. And that is a beautiful change in kinds of everyday practice. Because we've gotten so used to a world where we just flow with the content rather than actually paying attention for a small period of time.
That is interesting. I hadn't really thought about that, that's what's key about Snapchat. But the other thing it raises, and this is another point you make, and one in actually my own reporting I have discovered, which is this notion that teens don't care about privacy. And in my experience in talking to teens, that was totally, by your much more extensive research, that's just not true.
Right.
And I think your analysis of this, from which you actually, I believe, draw the title of the book, it's complicated.
Yeah.
And their ideas are complicated about privacy.
Privacy was probably the thing that changed the most during the 10 years in which I was studying teenagers. When I started out looking at MySpace, which is sort of where the story began, MySpace was relatively public. People were very happy to share things because, by and large, adults weren't paying attention. If anything, the adults that were paying attention were your older cousins who were in their early 20s, and they were cool. Once adults started getting on the site, things changed. And I saw that change, of course, really kick into full speed with Facebook. And what you started to realize is that young people wanted to be in public, but that didn't mean that they wanted to be public, which is to say that they didn't want everything to be there forever for access by anybody across all space and all time. And so they started really struggling with that issue, which is that their parents would say, well, you made it public, so I have the right to look at it. And they're like, I don't want you in my business. Go away. Right? And it's this sort of fight that emerged. And so what I started to see was that young people started to develop more and more sophisticated strategies as attempts to achieve privacy. And in light of this, what I started to realize is that privacy is not simply the control of information. Instead, it's the ability to control a social situation, which is to understand the social situation, how you will be interpreted, how that information will get used. And in order to do that, you have to have some sort of power or control or, you know, agency in a meaningful sense. You have to understand the context in which you're operating. You have to understand, like, I have the skills to manipulate and maneuver across these different ways. And so I saw a beautiful set of strategies in a variety of different directions, but I'll give you sort of one of the more common, which I refer to in the book as social steganography. Steganography is an old crypto term that basically means hiding in plain sight. And so I'll give this to you as an example, which is in the book, which is of a young woman named Carmen. And Carmen is of Argentinian descent, and she can rely on the fact that her mother knows nothing of British cultural references, which will be important to this story in a moment. And she, you know, loves that her extended family is all on Facebook. It's a place where they all hang out. She loves this. But her mother tends to overreact to everything that's emotional in any way, shape, or form. And so she's really struggling because she wants to express to her friends that she and her boyfriend had just broken up, and she was feeling lousy, and she wanted their love and validation and support. She knew that if she posted anything emotional, her mother would think she was, you know, suicidal. It had happened before. It was a problem. And she was trying to figure the perfect song lyric to express herself. Because, of course, if you're a teenage girl and you're trying to express emotions, song lyrics are definitely the way to do it. So she's trying to find the perfect one. And she realizes that her friends had recently gotten together and watched a movie, and that there was a great song in there that she knew her mother wouldn't recognize. And it's a very geeky reference. She decides to post song lyrics to always look on the bright side of life. Now, if you don't know the Monty Python reference, this is a song sung during Life of Brian in which the key character is being crucified. There is nothing happy about this song, right? But the lyrics look so wonderful, right? Always look on the bright side of life. She posts it. Her mother immediately comments, "It looks like you're having a great day." And her friends text her, right? And this is this beautiful way of her putting things up while maintaining some semblance of privacy. And what I saw as young people were engaging with these technologies is that they were finding all sorts of ways to game it. They were using pronouns and references to Friday night activities where they knew that their friend groups would understand it. And it was a way of meaningfully achieving privacy, using the kinds of codes that were around them. And that's why I thought it was really fascinating that this cohort of young people, even in light of the fact that they're used to parental surveillance, even in light of the fact that their material is very accessible, they're finding ways to achieve privacy in public.
The other thing is, I think another story that you told sort of struck me, which is talking with a college admissions officer about a young man who was from a community where there were gangs. Yep. But sent in an essay. They were very impressed with this young man. And then they went and looked at his Facebook page. And this is one of or MySpace page. And this is one of those stories where this is exactly what parents are afraid of.
Yep.
And he had all this sort of gang colors, and they were like, you know, what? But it had something to do, you were talking about his idea of privacy and who he thought was looking. And that a lot of these times, like all of us, they're writing to a certain audience.
Well, he was a more tricky situation. So this young man had written to this college application process, and he wrote about wanting to leave behind the gang-ridden culture that he grew up with. And this was at the beginning of the MySpace phenomenon, and the admissions office was proud of the fact that they were looking up people on social media because they saw this as a very good thing. And they called me up because they asked me this question: why would he lie to us when we can tell the truth online? And the assumption was what they read online, invalidated anything he'd written in this college admissions essay. Now, I spent a lot of time in South Central, and I knew full well that that community, gang affiliation is not simply a choice. It is a survival mechanism in a lot of these communities. Your siblings are affiliated. Your cousins are affiliated. Your extended family is affiliated. You affiliate in order to survive. And MySpace became a performance of that survival, a performance that had to be extraordinarily public, or your meaningful association was brought into question. And this is where I started to see this problem that occurs, and I think this is really important to think about in terms of privilege, which is to say that young people who are living in these environments where the norms within their home community are very, very different, struggle to deal with other norms where the context and the expectations are very different. And this taken out of context issue becomes so deeply disturbing, especially for young people who lack privilege in this country. And I think this is one of the things I struggle with over and over in trying to make sense of a lot of this material, which is that often this stuff gets read or interpreted along the norms of a much more privileged part of society, especially when you think about college admissions, when you think about, you know, who actually, you know, jobs and applications and whatnot, and who actually loses. We tend to narrate these conversations of like, oh, it's the college kid with their red cup that's going to get into trouble when they're off into the real world. Actually, they're going to live down those red cups. I'm not worried about them. I'm really worried about low income, especially Black and Latino youth, as they're struggling to make sense of how they get to be validated or make sense within their home communities versus what they have to do to make it in more in privileged environments. You know, there's a beautiful academic text that was written a long time ago in British culture called Learning to Labor, How Working Class Kids Get Working Class Jobs. And one of the things about that book is it talks about how the transformation of class in British society requires leaving behind the class values in the community that you came from. Because to make that transition, you need to actually create a break. This book was actually written in the 70s. There was more recent work that was replicated in the U.S. that shows this. In the United States, we now have lower class mobility than we ever have had in history. And at this point, we have lower class mobility than the UK does, which is devastating when you think about it, right? That's how far we've gone. And I think that social media becomes a dynamic where we actually, in many ways, reinforce class divisions because we judge people based on the place where we come from. And that judgment is so much more intense when it is the privilege judging those who are coming from working class environments.
You know, this actually brings me to another point you made, which is, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has kind of famously said young people don't care about privacy. Eric Schmidt has made comments about privacy being over. And you make a point that kids aren't digital natives, they're digital naives.
Yeah.
And I think, again, this is some of what concerns parents, in that in some ways, it is in the interests of certain people, I think what you're saying here, to say privacy's over, to claim it's over, because then Facebook can say, if teens want privacy, then they got to work at it and they have to do all these things if they really want it, but they don't really want it anyway. So it's sort of serving their interest.
So I want to clarify, the digital natives, digital naives is actually Esther Hargitay, who's an amazing sociologist at Northwestern, so I'm cribbing off of her for that. But I think that the point is still well taken, that this often propagates this understanding that if this material is public and people don't care about privacy, then we have the right to use it for any purpose. Now, what Esther was pointing to when she talked about digital natives versus digital naives is that young people don't have the sophisticated ways of understanding how this material will get used and reappropriated. They're assumed to understand this because they're part of a technical generation. Actually, their technical fluency is abysmal, in part because we don't teach technical literacy at all in this country. We do not teach media literacy at all in this country. And so what you end up seeing is that these young people are trying to make sense of it as they go. They're doing it within their social environments. They're willing to experiment, and that experimentation is important. But just because they're using these technologies doesn't mean they understand them at all. Now, as they participate in these very public environments, they leave traces. I will say that young people, when it comes to privacy with regard to corporations or governments, young people understand and care about this as much as adults, which is to say, not very much. Chris Hufnagel over at Berkeley has done phenomenal work in this arena. And part of it is, of course, this is not set up to help you understand what's going on. And what's really troubling to me is that we often blame teenagers. We're like, well, okay, then they don't understand it, then it's their fault, it's their problem. Or we blame these large institutions and we're like, it's their fault. Actually, it's a process of trying to figure this out, and we need to do this culturally. And that's where I really struggle with it, because working these things out is really complex. It's really hard to think about how information flows. I don't really want to depend on young people. Now, that said, I want to acknowledge something. Young people are looking for a place where they can hang out. Given that, I think it's completely fair that they choose to do it in these very public-private enterprises, which is that that's their only option, their only viable option. So I think that the damage in all of this is that, you know, we go to this moment, okay, they're naive, they don't understand it, so maybe we should block them. And that actually is the worst step in this logic, because blocking them means that they are not figuring out how public life works. The thing that I think is beautiful about watching young people navigate these things is, as they're trying to do it, they're trying to make sense of public life. And we, as adults, spend so much time limiting their access to public life rather than encouraging them to try to do it. But when it comes to the privacy issues, it needs to be a public debate. And I'm really, I mean, you have been very helpful. We have Cindy from AFF is here. We have a lot of people in this room that have been really passionate about issues of privacy that need to get out and be a part of that public debate.
You know, it's interesting. I did a piece, and I think I even talked to you for this piece, where I was talking about with some parents and their teens about, really, as a parent, what do you do? Because if your kids are going to go on these sites, do you monitor them? Do you stand over them? And make sure they're not doing anything bad. But then the kids find, they run away. They find Snapchat, or they find AskFM, a site that, you know, has gotten publicity because it was associated with a couple teen suicides because of bullying. So, yeah, what do you do? I'm sure a lot of parents think about that.
Sure. I also want to debunk some of the myths about Ask.fm.
Yes.
You know, one of the challenges as parents is how to engage in this way where you can actually build trust. I think one of the most heartbreaking things that I've seen from young people is they'll often come to me and be like, what did I do that was so wrong? Why does my mom not trust me? And that just, like, that kills me when I hear these questions, especially from kids who are really just trying to make things work. And part of it is that we've created this environment where parents are only good parents when they're in their kids' business all the time. We continue to narrate this, like, you're a bad parent if you're not constantly stalking your kid online. I mean, that's a terrible thing to set up, because it means that as a parent you feel as though you're incompetent, and that you're, you know, you have to know what everything is about every new technology. And then it creates these anxieties. And I watch so many parents be so anxious in ways that are actually fundamentally unhealthy for their relationships with their children. The thing that I advise parents is, like, stop trying to stalk everything your kids do. You need to build a relationship of trust, and you need to do it in a way where you realize it's a process, which is that when your children are children, when they are small, they're very dependent on you. They're going to communicate nearly everything with you. As they go through that transition, teenage years are going to be rocky, and those communication dynamics are going to go up and down, and that's par for the course. But your responsibility and your goal is to help them become independent. Because the last thing that, you know, I will say with my professor hat on, it kills me when I've got these 18-year-olds that come into my classroom and it's their first moment of independence and all of a sudden they don't know how to deal with anything. Your responsibility as a parent is to do that transition. What that means is that you've got to give them more freedom, more flexibility to try things out, and you've got to pull things back at different points when they're overstepping their boundaries. How you do this in your household has to be driven by your values, driven by what's really important for you. And it's a process. Now, the things that sort of small tactics that I can really encourage parents to do is, First, stop focusing on your child and start focusing on your children's friends, which is to say that your child, if you're really an engaged parent, is not going to be the biggest problem. They're not going to be the most unhealthy situation. But it's likely your child has friends whose parents aren't engaged. So start communicating and being supportive of them. If you're supportive of them when their lives are going, running into trouble, you will also get to hear when things are happening with your child that really need an intervention. Which is to say, if your son's best friend is, his parents are going through a divorce, if you're supportive and there as a caring adult that is non-custodial, you will end up building out a healthy environment within your child's broader peer group. The other thing I strongly recommend for parents is build a large network of other adults in your child's life. The aunts, the uncles, the cool cousins, the coaches, whoever it is within your community. Because the thing is that your child will tell those adults things that they won't tell you. And if you have that world of other adults in their lives, it will be extraordinarily supportive. The other thing is that your child will invite those other adults into their online world. And you know what? Those other adults, they're not going to rat your child out when he's been, swearing or doing other things that are lightweight. But when things start to look serious, then they'll call you up and you'll be able to know what's going on. The other thing is to start doing some symbolic moves where it's really about recognizing trust. So there's often a common online safety narrative that you have to have your child's password for every site. And in this way, a lot of adults feel as though then they have the right to sit there and watch and try to interpret every conversation. And this gets misread all over the place. My intervention is to do something much more simplistic, which is go find an old school piggy bank, the kind that actually have to be broken to get access to it. And everybody in the household, all adults and kids, put their passwords for every site in it. Little hint, put the date on it so that when you change your password, you can put it in a new piece of paper without having to break the piggy bank. And the thing is that anybody in the house can break that piggy bank. What that means is you always have access to your child's password, right? But the thing is that you only do it at a moment where it becomes important, and everybody in the household knows that piggy bank is broken. Of course, is this, perfect? No, of course you can get a different piggy bank that looks exactly the same. There's all sorts of ways to break this. But that moment of symbolizing that this is about a trust dynamic can go so far while still allowing that kind of safety. But it's really about constantly working at that dynamic of trust, letting your kids have freedom, and navigating it.
this is going to lead me into a question from the audience and kind of comes out of what you're saying. I in this piece I recently did, I interviewed a transgender teen, and the mom really gave him pretty much free rein after a lot of discussion, but regularly discussed with him his perceptions of what he was seeing, because there was a lot of ugliness online. And so she was helping him deal with the ugliness and the nastiness. And I have to say, in talking to him, he seemed pretty secure about the stuff. He was able to brush people off as just, they're like, kind of jerks, and, the teen seemed to be navigating it well.
Well, those dynamics of parenting are still extraordinarily important. Build up the confidence, help your child develop resilience, help them appreciate empathy. That stands online or off.
And this question, which, because one of the things this particular teen who was having some struggles at school said to me, sometimes the internet is my only friend. And somebody in the audience has asked, how do you perceive the place of social media in the development of a teen's sexuality? And I think this was a transgendered youth who I think sometimes also found support.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the heartbreaking through lines in which I've studied this is around LGBT youth. The reason why it was heartbreaking to me is, as a queer kid growing up online, I actually had great opportunities to come out online, to talk with, have these amazing conversations about sexuality with all sorts of strangers that I never met in a world where we weren't really afraid of it. One of my first projects when I was in my first graduate school program was to go back and look at what happened with LGBT youth who were engaging online. And what I found was that things had really changed from the period in the mid-90s where I grew up to the early 2000s. And during the early 2000s, there was so much religious intolerance towards LGBT communities, that the result of which is that these young people, whenever they were trying to engage on LGBT issues, would get chastised and be told by particularly Christian fundamentalists that they were going to hell not such nice versions of that. So this was sort of interesting because throughout the 90s, we saw a decrease in suicide that was correlated with access to the internet, which was pretty phenomenal. So I saw this and I started wondering how this thing was changed. And so but when that moral panic started, circulated really about MySpace, I saw a real shift in LGBT youth. And I kept hearing from queer youth that basically were saying to me, like, I don't talk to strangers on the internet. They're dangerous. They're going to rape me. And I'm just like, whoa, this is terrifying. And so I was like, well, where do you go to get support? And they would be like, well, I don't. And I'm like, uh-oh, that's going to be a bad through line. So this was sort of, I was struggling with this. And then along came Dan Savage and his It Gets Better campaign. And at first, of course, all the media was like, this is amazing, it gets better, this is supportive, we're loving and whatnot. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure this is going to go over so well. Mm. And I started looking into young people who were putting stuff up online. And what I found was that young people made their own videos all over the place, It Gets Better videos, that they would put up online hoping that they would then get love, support, validation, and find community. And that's not what they got. What they got was attacks by strangers and, more importantly, attacks by their peers. And the thing that killed me was that as I tracked public records of young people who died by suicide in the years following the It Gets Better campaign, the LGBT youth who were identified as such in media reports, most of them had made It Gets Better videos. Do I know whether or not we've actually seen a rise again? I do not. We don't have enough data to show this. But I really struggle with it because there is no doubt amongst LGBT youth, and especially if you talk to any LGBT individual who's in their 30s who had internet access, they will talk about the internet as being absolutely critical to their coming-of-age process. And that is not what I see amongst most young people, because most young people are too afraid to talk to strangers online, or they do so and nobody comes back to actually help them. And that I really struggle with.
That is really interesting. I mean, I wondered if it had changed, because it did seem like for a while it was a place to find.
It was, and I think it still is community. For some, and I actually hope we get back there. We're now far enough away from the moral panic with MySpace that it might be a little bit better for a little while, but that's why I get very nervous whenever we have these moral panics around young people talking to strangers, because it's, for so many young people, it is a lifeline to talk to strangers. And I'll say this with, you know, one other thing, which is that I'm on the board of an organization called Crisis Text Line, which is a service that allows young people to text in to counselors, trained counselors who will help them with every crisis you can imagine, from suicide ideation to sexuality issues, et cetera. And it is, I mean, we get thousands of messages every week from young people seeking out help and support. And it's really great to be in a service that we know we can match people to get that help. But what becomes really clear in all of this is how few resources that they have to get support from people. And it breaks my heart, because the internet connects people and it has so much potential, but the fear-mongering and the culture around it mean that we don't encourage young people to find those support. And for a lot of young people, they don't have it in their home community. So how do we rebuild it beyond that?
Somebody asked from the audience here, do you find that forcing youth to use their legal names online makes them safer?
So that question becomes a little complicated. First is the question of what does it mean? I love it. It's complicated. It becomes a very useful title, yeah. Just keep putting out there over and over again. The understanding of what it means to put out real names usually falls into two different categories. One is this question about how it affects meanness and cruelty and bullying. And the one thing I will say is that there seems to be no correlation in terms of using real names and a decline in meanness and cruelty and bullying. And I'll go into that in a second. The other section is whether it makes them safer with regard to other dangers that are usually imagined. And it seems to have no meaningful correlation to things like sexual victimization. It does, you know, in some cases encourage young people to be more attentive to the idea that they're going to be read by college admissions officers, by, you know, other, you know, military recruiters, et cetera. And so you see some benefits that occur when they use that name in a respectful way, and you see some problems when they're publishing stuff under that name that's not actually well interpreted. But I want to dive into the issue of meanness and cruelty, since that's often where this issue gets really murky. And I guess it's back to that Ask.fm question.
Yes, it's so funny. That was the next thing I was going to ask you. And I know you want to qualify it, because I
I even mentioned those suicides, and I know that a lot more goes on.
So I'm gonna pull through some of the meanness and cruelty understandings of what happens with this, and I'll get to the Ask FM in light of that, which is that as adults, we usually use the word bullying to refer to every aspect of meanness and cruelty, from lightweight teasing to serious forms of criminal harassment. This actually does an injustice to how we deal with these issues, because it really depends on where in that spectrum you are in terms of your interventions. Interestingly, in a rare occurrence, young people use the word bullying in the same way that that researchers do. Researchers have a more clinical terminology to it. It's psychological, physical, or social aggression repeated over time by people of differential physical or social power. For young people, it's basically the big kid picking on the little kid, the cool kid picking on the geek, that dynamic, right? And that's only one part of the spectrum. Now, when you actually stabilize that definition of meanness and cruelty, or stabilize that definition of bullying, you see that there's no bullying on the rise in the last 30 years. More importantly, what we find is that when you interrogate young people today about it, what you find is that it's worse at school with greater emotional duress with more significant consequences than it is online, which is really shocking. So usually what parents then respond with, well, it continues online, at home, even though it's happening at school. So it's much worse because it doesn't stop at the schoolyard. Well, there's a trick to that, which is that actually so does the support and love and validation that happens around that kind of meanness and cruelty. So what happens is that some drama occurs at school, it continues on, there's a lot of meanness and cruelty at home, but so does the love and the validation and support. Now, the reason why this gets twisted is where we get to Ask.fm. So I started studying FormSpring, which was the precursor to Ask.fm. Both of them are question and answer services. Now, the way that these question and answer services work is that anybody can anonymously ask a question, and then once the person who receives that question decides to respond, then it appears on the profile. And so everybody's talking about this like, oh, this is terrible. This is the site of terrible cruelty and bullying. And I was sitting there going, why would teenagers respond to a really cruel question when it's only once they've responded that it becomes visible? That doesn't make sense. So I called up the folks at FormSpring. I said, help me figure this out. And they came back to me and said, I've got bad news for you, and I don't understand this. And I was like, what's going on? And they were like, the same IP address is anonymously asking the question as is answering it.
And in other words, an example of the kinds of things we're talking about, too, so people really kind of
What can I say that's polite? Why are you so awful? Usually with a lot more foul words. It's like, you know, I think that you're a terrible person. Everybody hates you. Why don't you die? Right? These kinds of things, usually with a lot more swear words. And so the thing is that why then would the same IP address be asking that kind of question as would answer it in under 20 minutes and a distance? Which is to say that it's the same young person who's asking a cruel question of themselves and responding to it. And what we found was that actually this was occurring over and over again, and that young people knew that if they responded to it, they looked tough, which was important, and that all of these other people then loved them and supported them and came back to them and gave them validation. Elizabeth Englender, who's a researcher, decided that she would go and investigate this and found that a third of young people admitted to self-bullying online, right? Which is shocking. Now, once you start to see these moments of these Ask.fm related suicide stories, what we started to interrogate is that many of these cases turn out to be situations including self-bullying. So now we've got a mental health issue, right? Why are we dealing with these young people who are really struggling in ways where they will be engaging a form of digital self-harm to get validation and support, and what are the cycles that we have created where that becomes normative? That, to me, is a big change with technology. Self-injury is not new, right? But this form of digital reputation self-harm as a way of getting validation is in many ways new. And it's deeply disturbing, but this is actually one of the reasons why I get very upset by the suicide-related stories in the media. Almost always they come, it's like, there's this one thing, this kid was bullied, and that's the end, and that's why they died by suicide. That is not how suicide works. These cases, when we look at them over and over again, turn out to have mental health components, and we as a society don't know how to deal with mental health. And I will say that the best reporting on this is done by Emily Bazelon. She did an amazing piece in Slate on the Phoebe Prince case, which is so much more complicated than anybody ever realizes. And I say this because every time you see a media coverage of a young person who dies by suicide, don't leap to the conclusion that you think it's so simple. These are complicated, and if we want to do an intervention on that, we need to figure out how we support young people's mental health in this country, because we're doing an abysmal job of it.
I wanted to follow up on that, but first, I have to do some radio business here. It is that time to remind our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Laura Seidel, digital culture reporter for NPR and your moderator for tonight's program. Our guest is youth and culture and technology expert Dana Boyd, discussing her latest book, It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens. And now that that business is over with, I'm going to follow up on that. In the sense that I do wonder, though, whether or not social media amplifies these problems in ways that make it any worse. I think about, you know, being a kid and struggling with a variety of things, and you might have something happen in the schoolyard, you're, you know, struggling with kids, and then it reappears. You sign in on social media, and it reappears, and it's reinforced. And so I'm wondering if you think it makes it any worse.
There is no doubt to me that social media amplifies the good, bad, and ugly. And the question is, how do you actually reach resolution? So one of the things about interpersonal conflict in general is that you have to go through a process to reach resolution on it. And the question is, how do you get there? And this is one of the reasons why when we deal with a world of meanness and cruelty, we have to think about developing empathy and resilience. Those two go hand in hand in one another. So what happens is that, you know, if there's a conflict at school, and it does continue on in the online, there are, it happens over and over again. The question is, does it give you enough space to then figure out how to respond or to make things visible enough that you can strategize with your peers or with your parents in ways that are actually effective to do an intervention? Does it always work? No. But the thing about bullying and meanness and cruelty in general is that this is not a new problem and we're constantly struggling with it. The things that we know make a difference are when we don't escalate these situations. And this is actually one of the and when we build resilience and empathy. Those are the, I mean, this is where you'll hear social emotional learning as a really dominant narrative in terms of school interventions. And the reason is that you actually need to go through a process of trying to diffuse these dynamics. The internet can diffuse and it can amplify. It goes both ways. But it also can be made visible to your peers in ways that are productive. And that's actually why it gets so messy, is that it's not so clean as, like, it just makes everything worse. It's not just simply that trend line. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not that surprised when we started seeing that young people reported that things were worse at school and we started drilling into it. We realized that that's because they had a conflicted dynamic with the internet. It made some things worse and it made some things better. And it was that dynamic that is part of the challenge with all of this. You know, are these issues hard? Absolutely. The other thing that I'd give to adults is to say, we have turned meanness and cruelty into a national pastime. This is our sport of how we do politics. This is our reality TV shows. This is our entertainment. We have made this so common in our society, and it's not surprising to me that young people are replicating it. But it's not even just at that media level. You know, I often would, you know, spend time in young people's homes, and I'd sit down at dinner tables with families, and, you know, these same parents who would lament to me that bullying was terrible, this was, you know, this terrible surge in their schools, would sit there and talk smack about their colleagues at work, or talk about, you know, the neighbor who annoyed them, or other things. And I'm sitting here going, do you realize that you are replicating a kind of meanness and cruelty that you are really upset when your children do this, right? And so the thing that I would say is be accountable and reflective about every time you talk negative about anybody, whether it is, you know, somebody you know or even, you know, a political figure who you disagree with, right? Because, you know, I don't have many nice things to say about many of our politicians, right? But it becomes this question of how do I emulate a level of respect for difference, because that is something that we have to really show to young people, because if we're constantly talking negatively about all of the people in our world, why should we expect them to then always talk positive about the people in their world?
You know, interestingly, a while back I did a piece on how nasty people are online, and sadly, part of it is that nasty comments, this is documented, get people pay more attention to nasty things than nice things. So if you say something nice, nobody pays any attention to you.
It's the negative dynamic, negative attention within schools, right? Yeah. Which is that if you're looking for attention, negative actions often get you that attention. And that we have to figure out how to address that culturally, but we can't put that on the backs of our children to figure out.
Somebody asked, police investigators and prosecution attorneys are using what they find on social media to bolster their cases, particularly in gang cases.
Yep.
How can youth protect themselves, or what can defense attorneys do to minimize or mitigate the impact of what youth post online? I did not realize that
This was.
Oh yeah.
You're nodding. So obviously this is increasingly.
Yeah. I actually spent a bunch of time. So I spent a bunch of time in Nashville, and so people don't realize it, but Nashville has the largest Kurdish street gang in the U.S. It's one of the rarest and oddest street gang dynamics, because it is almost all kids who parents moved here in the 70s, 80s, had kids who were Muslim, who basically were middle class kids in this community until 9/11 happened. And then all of a sudden became targets of all sorts of hate that you can imagine, formed a street gang, and have created the largest significant Kurdish street gang in the country. And it was really interesting because I was interviewing all of these young people who are gang affiliated in Nashville at the same time that I was interviewing and talking to law enforcement. And what I saw was really interesting was that law enforcement was totally trolling social media, looking for every reference. But young people had gotten to the point where they were even producing videos knowing that the law enforcement were watching them. And they would literally wave to the police officers at the beginning of YouTube videos. And you were just like, oh my gosh, what is going on here? And you start to realize that part of gang dynamics are saying that they're trying to actually have strength constantly in opposition to law enforcement in different ways. And it's this actual tension and this tense fight that emerges between law enforcement officers and gang-affiliated youth, because it's a moment of empowerment. And actually getting attention from law enforcement is half the point, which is actually really difficult to watch sort of play out in all of this. The thing that if you want to address these kinds of issues, law enforcement is not the place of point of first contact. And I think this is where I really struggle with it across all the spectrum of issues that I deal with. So I've been working on a project on commercial sexual exploitation of children for a while, otherwise known as human trafficking or child sex trafficking. And one of the things that people don't appreciate is how problematic law enforcement's relationship with young people is on this. So law enforcement at this point will troll places like Backpage and Craigslist, trying to make sense of this stuff. And they do it in ways that will often result in them arresting teenagers. And in different states around this country, it's easier to arrest a child. And I will run into law enforcement over and over again who will be like, well, they're safer in jail than they are in the street. Right? And of course, this creates an unbelievably terrible dynamic between law enforcement and young people. But people don't realize why a lot of young people end up in commercially sexually exploitive situations. It tends to fall into two really clear tracks, and they're both really connected. Their parents are often part of the problem. If their parents hadn't sold them into the trade to begin with, which is actually much more common in this country than people realize, they were abusive enough that the child ran away. Which is really difficult to watch. And part of it has to do is this is also a dynamic around poverty, right? And the more that we start to see the rise of different aspects of poverty in the country, the more we're going to have a problem. We have a record high number of homeless youth. Guess what? Many of these youth are engaging in the sex trade in ways that are purely survival related. And their relationship with law enforcement is extraordinarily unhealthy. The kinds of interventions that are needed aren't necessarily about protecting young people against law enforcement or giving law enforcement the tools to go after it, but trying to actually create the right ecosystem where we're not running into these problems to begin with. This is about doing different kinds of issues, addressing poverty, addressing homelessness, addressing the complex issues that we often don't know how to deal with, and so we think that we can solve this through technology, and it becomes deeply frustrating. The other thing that I will say is that we don't live in a post-racial society, no matter what the color of the skin of our president is, and I think it's really destructive when we think that young people of color, their relationship to law enforcement in this country is one of fear and one of doubt and one of disrespect because they're not confident that they will be respected in return. And so this is one of the reasons, I'm coming from New York City, right, where we're having a nice battle over stop and frisk, which is a very serious issue. But we need to actually deal with those dynamics because they only get magnified when we start to use technology to reinforce structural power issues.
On that note, I actually, we're here in San Francisco, which has been one of the centers is the center here at Silicon Valley, of the tech revolution. And a lot of the sort of techno-utopians, I think, saw the internet as an equalizer, as a place where we could all communicate with each other and see each other. And this goes to some of what you're saying. That's not actually what's happening. I remember actually a number of years ago you and I talked about when MySpace was still viable, there was a point at which MySpace became the place where minorities and people from lower income were going, and Facebook was the place where white yep. people were going. I mean, that's shifted now. But essentially, we're saying the same stuff we see in our societies happening online.
Yeah. Now, social media is really about you connecting with the people in your network. And one of the things that we know in this country is that those networks are very much shaped by the politics of race and class in this country. Nowhere was that more visible to me than when I started actually doing, you know, network maps of things, where I would go into schools and they would be like, we are a racially diverse school, people just get along here. And I'm like, really? And then I would map out the social dynamics that were occurring on, you know, the project was done during the MySpace era, and I would find that actually every racial division that, you know, existed in society was reproduced in those schools in terms of who talked to one another, who took pictures with one another, who was commenting each other's, materials, and that continues to this day. So even with schools where, in theory, we see racially diverse populations, they end up getting reproduced in really structural ways. The reference to MySpace versus Facebook is really interesting because it was about the 2006 to 2007 school year. It was during that period, and it was because I was sitting in a town outside of Boston. I was talking with a young person, and she was getting really nervous and uncomfortable because I was asking her about MySpace and Facebook, and she looked at me and goes, "Well, you know, I don't mean to be racist or whatever, but you know, MySpace is kind of ghetto." And I was like, "What?" And I started asking her to unpack this, and I basically started to realize that what she was using was a language of race and class to refer to the dynamics that were happening on MySpace, and that she was reproducing language that was coming through the media. It was dangerous. It was unsafe. It was, you know, it was gaudy. It was gauche. It was like the place of urban people, right? And it was just like, oh. Whereas Facebook at the time was narrated as a safe, quiet, private, clean alternative, right? And that basically got racialized in really key ways, and the young people had basically separated themselves into whether they were MySpace people or Facebook people. I wrote this as a essay online, and I got a lot of attention from it in a very short period of time, where most adults were telling me that I was wrong in every which way and then some, but teenagers kept coming back to me and saying that it was true, and they gave me more details about how to deal with it. The reason that this became important is that we often use racialized language to talk about social media without even realizing it. The way we describe it, the way we describe which populations it's attractive to, who we describe it as being for, what it looks like, how it fits into our cultural ecosystem, how it fits into our labels, like whether it's hipster or whether it's goth or whether it fits into any of these categories. Now, the reason that this becomes important is that even during that era in which Facebook was the dominant player, which was a really interesting moment of time, how people were using Facebook differed by race and class. How people, you know, participated on what they did with it, which communities they were talking to. We are now in an ecosystem where we've fragmented, right? You know most of the major fragmentation sites. Instagram, Tumblr, Twitter, Snapchat, etc., WhatsApp. The thing that people don't realize is that there's a whole layer of other apps that most do not make it into the big time visible element. And the reason why is that those apps are actually segmented by geography, by race, by class at this point. Right? So there are so many services out there that are used by different demographics. And of course, the ones that the media pay attention to, the ones the venture capitalists pay attention to, the ones that are recognized in this city are inevitably those that are being used and recognized by the most privileged populations.
That I think that's generally very, very true. And it's easy when you live here in this particular bubble, I think, to get sucked into that. I there's a question here that I feel like, oh, this is kind of a fun question. And I know the answer, but they probably want to know. Are you a parent?
I am. I have my son is only 8.5 months old, so he's
not using social media yet.
Well,
or are you teaching him? I mean, you know,
I joke. You know, I travel a lot, and so as far as he's concerned, "Mommy in a box" is his relationship to Skype, right? Which is so, you know, he's getting it, he likes the device because it means mommy's on the other side somewhere. But no, I mean, yes, I'm a parent. I think one of the challenging things about doing this research is that, you know, everybody's like asking me, it's like, oh, now that you're a parent, are you going to change your mind? I'm like, no, I'm really confident of the research. But what the research did was really make me rethink how I wanted to be a parent. Huh. And what I realized in all of this, in looking to talking to so many young people, is that the best thing that I can give to my son is to try to be calm and try to be present. And that stress and anxiety and fear are actually some of the most destructive dynamics that I see between parents and children. And so it's really made me think about how to be a parent more than it's going to make me rethink my research.
And I'm curious, you know, as a parent, will you be comfortable very quickly with him interacting with media?
He's going to grow up in a world where technology is a part of it. And he's going to see his parents on these devices in different ways. And my hope is to give him a level of respect with this technology and to help him find a way to relate to it in meaningful ways. It's a long time until he's really genuinely social on this. Heck, you know, he's right now hanging out with his cousin, and I don't think that either one of them has acknowledged the other yet, right? Like, we're not at a point of that level of sociality. But I don't know what the technologies are when he's going to be there, but my responsibility and my hope for him is that help him navigate this world, mediated and unmediated.
Well, yeah, I guess that's kind of what all parents hope in this crazy new world. I think we are about out of time, so I want to thank Dana Boyd, I keep wanting to say Dana because it's easier.
It depends on which part of my family. It actually is both.
But is it?
I said Dana because I'm so American.
Yeah.
It's painfully American.
All right. Well,
you can go with either.
Either or, Dana or Dana Boyd, the principal researcher at Microsoft and author of the new book, It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens. And we also thank our audience here on the radio, television, and internet. And I guess you get to clap. Can they clap?
Thank you, Laura. Thank you.
I'm Laura Seidel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.